Good morning, brothers and sisters. Today is a great show. I'm so happy. Luigi, it's been a long time. Actually, last time we met each other, I thought for sure by now we have an alien invasion.
You really like, think you so?
Know, well, at least, Project Bluebeam. This is Jason Cavalier. He's here in the studio to tell us and help us to ask you questions, because I'm sure you have a bunch of questions yourself on this subject. You're interested. Yeah.
That's cool.
Jason is actually, to the audience, we're going to talk about aliens. Jason, you're technically an alien, right? Or you play one in...
Honestly, I don't know. I could be. I told Luigi a little bit my origin, before we came in, so I don't know. I'll ask his opinion.
But jokes aside, he played an alien recently in Guardians of the Galaxy, the video game. And he did an amazing job. And you played Drax. So he's the voice and action of Drax in the game.
That's
so
really
if you do play video games, please...
By the way, you know
the connection. You know, actually, me and Jason went to the same high school. Okay, years apart. He's a bit older than me, without discriminating. But we went to the same high school, had same teachers, had the same gymnastics teacher.
We had the same phys ed teacher.
Phys ed teacher. That's true. It's 100% true.
That's cool.
And another connection. I did that video game with you, not as much as you did. I didn't have a significant role like you did.
Well, you were for a period of time, you were Groot.
You were the
physical.
Yeah, I was the body of the Groot.
Really?
Yeah. So if you play the video game, you can play both of us.
Oh, that's cool.
By the way, it's true fact. My first video game, I think 97 or 90, 98, no, not 97, 98, 99, the college video games, basketball. That's the first time I saw myself, like I could play myself on a video
game.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, I know.
What platform was that?
PlayStation 2, maybe?
Oh,
PlayStation 1? PlayStation 1, maybe even? Yeah, PlayStation. No, 98 is PlayStation 1, right?
Yeah,
98 would be
probably.
PlayStation.
Yeah.
Wait, did you shoot that in Montreal?
No. I don't even know how they did it back then. But
where was the mocap done? Here?
No, there's no mocap. There's just me as a character.
I didn't
do any mocap.
They based the character on you.
They take all the real players. Yeah. They take all the real players. I don't know if they were, I don't remember. I don't think they used the names because of NCAA regulations, but like the movement wasn't exactly me, but you can tell they're trying to match the movement the best possible. It was interesting. It was interesting how they did. I didn't do any mocap, but it's like, well, that's me. So I was in college for 5 years, so I had a video game for 5 years with me in it. Interesting. That's a side story. None of you are interested in this. But Luigi, go ahead.
Pretty cool.
What's the... we talked about aerial phenomenon last time. And I watched some of that, whatever was on YouTube, but not the whole thing. I thought by now it would be released, and there's an interesting story associated with that. Like, is that a conspiracy theory that it hasn't been released? Is it a sabotage? What's the story with aerial phenomenon?
Yeah, that for anybody who knows what aerial phenomenon is, right? It was it's a big documentary that's been worked on for the past 12, 13 years. And it's about this event in Africa where these kids had a big experience where a craft landed and beings came out and communicated to the kids, like in broad daylight. So this is something that's been circulating since 94. There's a lot of people that jumped on it. And at the time, when Dr. John Mack was alive, he was the one that flew from Harvard. He went down to Zimbabwe. This was in Africa to meet up with these kids to make sure that this is something that potentially really happened. And at the time, John Mack was the head of psychiatry at Harvard. And so his implication put this thing on the map. And he eventually died tragically 10 years after the event. And when that happened, the John Mack Institute already existed in New York. And if I'm not wrong, at a certain point, even Rockefeller had funded part of John Mack's study on this stuff. And when he passed away, Randall Nickerson, who was actually an abductee who knew John Mack, had become real close friends with him, had decided to take on the project to make a documentary film on this event. And that's how it all got started. So Randall, who has his own backstory, who's been on Oprah Winfrey at the time when John was alive and talking about abductions and all that, what happened to him, what happened to his sister. And he took this to heart because he knew this was a real phenomenon. He knew something happened in Africa with these kids. So he decided, let's make a big documentary about this. And this was a project that took almost 13 years to make, and a lot of money to make, because you got to travel. He traveled the world. There was 62 children that were recorded back then in 94 when this happened. So he had to find these kids. They had moved away. This was a school, an elementary school in South Africa that had kids from all over the world. So they were not just from Africa. Some of them were Canadian, American, Australian. They were kids of people that were in Africa at the time to help. So there was pastors, there was Salvation Army people helping. So these were just the kids of all these people helping, because Zimbabwe was really hardcore back then. There was a lot of atrocities that were going on. So a lot of people went down there to help. So these kids were like international, all in this little primary school in the middle of Rua, Zimbabwe, which is a rural area outside of Harare, the capital of Zimbabwe. And eventually, after all this happened, you know, they moved away. So Randall had to find them. That took forever. Had to fly and meet up with some of them. That expensive stuff to do. Then eventually had to find the teachers, the people that were there. They're eventually start realizing that this didn't just happen at the school. This happened all over Zimbabwe at the time. And there's part of that is going to be shown, that it is shown in the documentary. So there's thousands of witnesses who saw craft, other witnesses who saw these crafts pretty up close. And there's airline pilots that went on the record that saw these things. There was radar confirmation that there was something in the sky. There was newspaper articles of people saying, we saw meteors in the sky, but meteors don't stop in the sky. So, you know, at the time, they didn't know what to print, so they wrote meteors. And then that kind of caught the attention of Tim Leach, who was a BBC reporter back in South Africa, who was reporting on the war zone in South Africa. So this is a guy who was used to some pretty hardcore shit out there. And a lot of his coworkers had got killed while they were filming. It was a really bad time in South Africa. So he was called in to go check out this thing, because he says, well, if it's just meteor showers, then why are these people saying they saw craft, and some of these kids say they saw beings and all that? So he went out there. And when he got out there, he realized this was not a meteor, you know? So if it wasn't a meteor, what the fuck was this? You know, what happened? And so there was a lot of tracing back to Tim Leach, tracing back to BBC footage, finding people who had gone to that school at the time to videotape some of these kids saying what they had seen. So that took forever, and that took a lot of resources. So Randall was kind of on his own doing this, and then got some people to help funding the whole project. And I got to meet one of the kids that was there. I got to meet her in 2015. She's a Canadian girl. Her parents were there. They were pastors working for the Salvation Army, helping out there. And her brother were at the school. And she communicated with these beings when they came down. And I got to meet her in Philadelphia in 2015. And I was super happy to meet one of those kids. It was the first time I had ever met one of them in person. I'd seen them on TV, or I'd seen them in interviews for years, because ever since this thing came out, I kind of knew about it. And her and I kind of started becoming friends. And because of my background in this field, where I've helped a lot of people in abduction cases, or just this phenomenon, I was able to demonstrate to her that I had a no judgment approach. I had a no criticism approach. I was very open and very understanding of some of the things that she wanted to talk about, and some of the traumas she was going through, because there was the trauma of the actual event, and then the trauma of the whole world telling her that she was crazy because there's no way aliens landed next to your school and talk to you, you know? So that was something that she was going through. Her brother had gone through something really, really rough as well. And coming from a Christian family, she had a lot of difficulties within her family because, you know, these are not things that happen. The aliens don't land and talk to you. This is not something that is supposed to happen. So that was a really hard life. And her and I kind of got close because I realized she's on her own. Like, she's basically on her own on this. And her family supported her. She had some support, but it wasn't something enough that was actually making a huge difference. So I got to meet her, and through her, she introduced me to Randall. Randall came to Montreal. I invited her to Montreal, got to meet Randall. Really super cool guy. I could tell that this guy was at first really wary of who the fuck am I? Like, you know, why am I seeing this guy, Luigi? Why am I going to share some of the information that we found and this? So it was the beginning of us meeting was kind of rough because he didn't know if I was going to be one of those other people wanted to take advantage of this, because that's what actually happened. A lot is a lot of people trying to take the story and take ownership of it and trying to do something on their own, because they knew how big the story was. And anyway, long story short, we became super good friends. I helped out throughout some of the years that we worked on this. We traveled to Arizona together. We've done a lot of the filming of the movie was actually done here in Montreal. And there's a couple of scenes right at the beginning of the movie that I used my drone at the time to, he wanted to have like a landscape of a Canadian city. So even though Emily lives in Toronto, we couldn't get a shot in Toronto. So we got a shot in Montreal. So there's actually a shot of Montreal. And
same thing.
Laval, it looks Montreal, it's pretty much all kind of looks the same, you know? So, and so this has been ongoing for years, and it's been a rough monetary thing, because when you try to do something right, you got to have the rights to everything. We got to have the rights to footage. You got to have the rights from the people who took the footage. You got to make sure you don't step on anybody's toes. You got to make sure everything is real. And that costs money. And there's a lot of licensing fees that came into that. So this whole process took forever. And there was a lot of people getting, you know, impatient. When's this movie coming out? When's this movie coming out? And we were super happy to say that it was going to launch in 2022. The pandemic actually delayed the launch of Ariel because it was supposed to launch before the pandemic or just around the beginning of the pandemic. And there was talks with some big Hollywood studios. I can't say who because there's still some shit going on. And I, you know, my personal opinion on this is that There's a few scumbags out there in Hollywood, and a few. Yeah, a few. Yeah. That's like saying, that's like being really like gentle about it, you know,
being nice.
Man. Yeah. Being really nice. Right. Yeah. So, you know, there's unfortunately the reality of the world is no matter how noble your work is, no matter how much you try to make it real, you're always going to be faced with some really shitty people. And some of them took advantage of the situation. I can't get into all the details yet. I'd love to, but as soon as I get the green light, trust me, I'll be really vocal about it. You'll publicly
come back for part three.
Yeah. And so the launch of the movie was supposed to be May 20th. And there was something that happened before that, that kind of screwed up a deal with a big distributor. And, I was kind of on the same page with Randall in a few points anyway. So the movie was going to be launched privately because there was so much movement behind this movie. There's so many people want to watch it that we felt the organic growth was going to be there. And the movie was put on the Ariel Phenomenon.com, Ariel, A-R-I-E-L, which is the name of the school, Phenomenon.com. And you could just rent it there. We put it on a platform. It was paid for. It was pretty good.
Poseidon, can you pull it up?
And
it's on the email.
On the 19th of May, which was the day before, the site got hacked. And yeah, there you go. And the site got hacked on the day before the launch. And what happened at that point is as soon as the film was launched, none of the payments were coming in, but nobody was getting their links to watch it. So it ended up being 7 days of erased logs. Somebody did something really serious. It was
intentional sabotage.
Intentional sabotage, yeah. And on that same day, there was an Instagram post sent to Aerial Phenomenon by a guy called Dave Nickerson, which is the same last name as of Randall. And I read it right away and it sent it to Randall. I said, who the fuck is Dave Nickerson? And on the Instagram, it was this description of how bad Randall was and how he screwed everything up. But the details in what was written were clearly from somebody that we knew on the inside on a distribution platform that was being an asshole. And I was like, that's that guy. And, you know, Randall's like, yeah, I think it is because I don't know any Dave Nickerson. He goes, but we don't have evidence of that. I said, well, I still think it's that fucking guy. You know what I mean? So I kind of got in trouble because I posted on my own personal Facebook. I said, there's some piece of shit in Hollywood that tried to block the movie. And then Randall called me. He's like, dude, you can't do that because we don't have evidence of that. I'm like, yeah, well, that's me. You know, that's like, I'm fucking real, you know, so I'm not going to sit down and just take it up the ass. So something happened and it really screwed up the launch of Aerial Phenomenon big time. So at the time, the tech guys that were on the film couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. So what we had to do is take the movie and put it on another platform that was not hacked. And that cost a lot of money. And it was eventually done. But obviously, we lost the first wave, you know, of orders. And a lot of people were like, I paid, I didn't get the movie. So that was like pretty unfortunate that happened that way. So it's now on Aerial Phenomena. You can watch, you can rent it off of Aerial Phenomena. It works. Everything works now. And hopefully there's going to be a deal with a big distributor soon where you'll be able to see it on like the known platforms, you know? So,
well, then straight to the point, how's Aerial Phenomena fits, even though it's a story of 94, but we have many stories that can happen in the past. They're coming out now. In a big way, in yeah. maybe in the most recent years, like tic-tac-toe videos. It didn't happen yesterday, but it's still a yeah. point that they use on the hearings and congressional hearings. How does the Aerial Phenomena fit into the whole disclosure? Does it play any role particularly, or is it just part of the whole disclosure process in general?
Well, what I'm about to say is kind of my opinion. So I don't want to speak on behalf of anybody involved because everybody's got their opinion on this. So I don't necessarily have a very optimistic view of the so-called disclosure that's happening now. That's my view. There's a lot of divert attention stuff that's happening. Aerial Phenomenon is basically a case of contact. It has nothing to do with UAP or UFO. Like, yeah, there was a craft, but it wasn't unidentified. It was clearly a disc-shaped craft that landed in front of these kids. Like, it's not something that they saw from far. It was a light or it moved on a camera. I can't tell. This was clear. This was 10:15 a.m. in the morning on a sunny day. This was clear. And these beings came out, these two strange looking beings. They were small. They had big black eyes.
Were
there's some descriptions of them that are very typical of the grays, which we all know are these skinny little bodies with these big heads and big black eyes. And then there's some of the other students who saw things that we don't usually associate with the grays, but they still had the big black. They all saw the big black eyes and the big head. They all saw that. There's variations in witness accounts from these kids. Some of them said one of them had black hair, which long black hair, which was really interesting because it's not something you hear about a lot. Yeah. And other ones were saying that they were completely, like they were wearing a black jumpsuit, very tight. Some of the kids are saying they were wearing a black jumpsuit. One of the kids says that was their skin. Like she got so close that she saw that was not a jumpsuit. It was their skin. And then other ones saying that their face was completely white. It was like, it looked like plastic and with these
no features,
just a big black eyes. So, and they were moving. They were like, if let's say the creature was where Alex is, well, and it wanted to move where Jason is, well, It didn't move there. It disappeared and appeared there. So it was like there was a second. It was moving in and out of reality in front of the kids.
You know, like a projection, maybe almost.
I don't think it was a projection. If I base myself on some of the,
dimensional.
I think it was more about something was happening that there was the kids. Some of the kids said that they felt that they were in a bubble. And you know, when you see the heat going off the asphalt mm-hmm. and you see that like distortion in view, they said it looked like that. Like there was a lot of distortion happening. So it's like, they don't know if they disappeared because a wave of distortion took them out of view for a second. So they couldn't, and plus they're like, they were kids. So they were freaking out because what the hell is that? And second of all, they're freaking out because whatever the hell that was came up to them and started communicating telepathically with the kids. So they started getting these messages and these images in their head, and they started like going, what the hell is going on? And this was, outside 62 kids were interviewed, but we're talking hundreds of kids were there. So there was a lot of people that were physically watching this, and it wasn't some type of abduction at night or some, I don't know if I was a lucid dream or I was, sleep paralysis. This was like real. Like right now it's 10:49. Well, half an hour ago, real to us, outside broad daylight while you're having your coffee, a fucking alien shows up. That's not the same as when somebody says, I felt something was in my room. So these kids saw something very real and they experienced something very real, and it caused them a tremendous amount of anxiety, of fear, of excitement, of a lot of emotions.
You said there was communication. Did they all, and that there's a discrepancy in the physical description of the aliens or the beings, whatever they say, but was there any discrepancy in the message or in the communication?
There was, I wouldn't say discrepancy. I think there was multiple different messages that were sent out to some of the kids. The main messages that I could basically accept as a final result of my investigation into this is the fact that the beings were talking to some kids about the air and the water and the earth, and how we have to be very careful about air and water. And there was another message sent to some kids about technology. There's a good way of using technology. There's a bad way of using technology. You can do better. So they received these messages while they were seeing images. So there was overload of data in a very short period of time. So these kids were seriously affected because, some of them were 6 years old, all the way to 13 years old. So there was quite a range. So, the perception of information between 6 years and 13 years is pretty big. Yeah. Because once you're 13, you really kind of understand a lot more of what the hell's going on. When you're a kid, when you're young at 6, 7 years old, you're still sort of innocent to the point where you are getting information, but you don't kind of analyze it the same way when you're a little older. So some of the older kids really got affected. One in particular was completely devastated by whatever happened. And there was other ones who were finding it to be very scary. Some of them were very sad. One of the things that I remember was that after these beings disappeared, because the bell rang, and as soon as the bell rang, they kind of got distracted. And in that instant, the beings were gone and the craft was gone. It was literally like, boom, it's gone.
Recess is over.
Right. it was crazy. And the most amazing thing that happened that day was that there was absolutely no adults outside when this was happening, because it was a teacher meeting happening inside. So they had a longer recess because of the teacher meeting. So they were happy to be outside and play longer. Remember when we were in school and the teacher said, you're going to have a longer recess. It was like, this is great. We're going to play ball or whatever. So they were there longer than usual, but the teachers were having this meeting. So when the event ended, all these kids ran inside the school screaming, like, what did this just happen? So you got all these teachers watching all these kids come in, all saying the same thing. At first, they thought it was a put on. It was like a joke, or like, come on, you know, can't be serious. And they slowly started realizing that it wasn't a joke. Like they actually saw something.
So the universal message was one of,
you have to be,
I don't want to say doom and gloom, but
well, they're
ominous.
It's, yeah, it was pretty ominous and sad, I would say, with a lot of the kids, and also very humbling, I guess. They were given, I mean, I'm going a little far because I know about this a little, mm-hmm. and I've spoken to some of them. It kind of gave me goosebumps many times because you're talking to them and you can feel the emotion that they have inside when you ask them, what did they tell you? And they're not just telling you like I would tell you, you know, like they talk about air and water, and I'm saying it in a very nonchalant, relaxed way while we're talking. They're telling their story with an enormous amount of emotion associated to it. So that you could tell this affected them.
So that's, in other words, it was a trauma.
Huge trauma. I mean, I'm talking huge. Yeah.
Communication, did they show them, like, was it visions of the future or what will happen if you don't?
One of the things that they remember, because the way Emily is one of the witnesses, she was there. This Emily is Emily Trim. She was one of the witnesses. And I know a lot because I spent many years with Emily. And she says it was like taking a book with a lot of pictures. And when you flip really fast and you see all these images, she says, that's what it kind of looked like. She goes, it was like thousands of images coming in and it was like overload. It was like she couldn't pinpoint one thing. But what a lot of them agreed was that the last image they saw was a huge mushroom explosion, like a huge fiery explosion. So they all saw that, which was concerning to them because it was made them very sad. Liesl, which is one of the little girls that was there, in an interview with John Mack, says all the trees would go down and there would be no air and everybody was dying, and that's what they saw. So it's obviously intense to show that to 7 or 8 year old, right? So the emotion that they were feeling carried on for many years. Because when they're telling people, this is what I saw, I think they experienced an emotional connection as well to whatever they were receiving, because you could tell that there's always an emotional association to whatever they're saying. And obviously to be very cautious and careful about our air and our water, which in 1994 in rural Zimbabwe, where there was literally 3 television stations, as Emily told me, and those 3 television stations were not talking about UFOs, we're not talking about Save the Planet, we're not talking about anything that could have been productive to change the way humans go about. It was like some super boring that TV that they wouldn't really watch. So for all these kids to be in that environment, which is completely different than what we're used to, because rural Zimbabwe in Rua, where this happened, there's not much out there. So for them to be on this sudden quest of talking about the environment and how we use technology, that in itself is a big thing, because these kids didn't have anything to make them say that before. Like, they didn't talk about that in school. That was not part of their curriculum. In school, they were learning about math and geography. And so that was really something. And I think that, in my opinion, the messages that these children got is probably what everybody should be focusing on. And when I say everybody, not the people like that study this phenomenon, but just people. And as far as the disclosure movement that's going on, the disclosure movement has absolutely no care about the planet. The disclosure movement is about, I want to know. I want to know what you're hiding. I want to know what you have behind that big curtain there. And it's like, who gives a shit about that? You know, like if this happened, then that's a separate thing. That's a completely different thing. If we can honestly all agree that it's very difficult to make 62 children, it's almost impossible to teach them how to bullshit professionally and con the head of psychiatry at Harvard who interviewed them individually, and to convince the head of psychiatry at Harvard that they were all saying the truth and that they must have seen this because that's what he had concluded. And that still today, so many years later, they have the same story and the same emotional baggage that comes with it. Then we as a species have to accept, like, there's something happened that day. It cannot be just dismissed as, well, mass hysteria or mass delusion or, come on.
Go ahead.
The professor, John Mack?
Yes, John Mack.
Was this something, or this subject matter, was this something he was involved with?
He wasn't, yeah. So John Mack got involved.
But that's why they chose him to go into.
Well, and actually they didn't choose him. He found out about it. And
okay.
Because it got, what the BBC spoke about it on a BBC broadcast. And John happened to be in London when that happened. So he was traveling to London for something and found out that this happened in Africa, and the BBC had obviously saw this on TV and got on a plane and flew right away to Zimbabwe.
Do you know at what stage in his life he became interested in this?
John was probably involved in this maybe 5 years before, around the time. He was Pulitzer Prize winner, incredible academic, incredible person who worked, had enormous accreditation and I mean, the head of psychiatry at Harvard. This is somebody who...
What was his military affiliation? Because I know he worked with the military at some point.
I wouldn't be able to give you some details. I don't have John, that. You could probably Google that.
Poseidon, it's open. If you open the second link in the email, in the top right corner, you see John Mack's picture. You click on that, it takes you right to the Wikipedia page.
It's possible that he's done some work. I mean, when you're at Harvard and you're kind of running the psychiatry part of Harvard.
The reason why I asked this question, and I'm going to be devil's advocate, because I'm not taking a stand here.
Just
a devil's advocate. We had a MK Ultra show. We recorded a lawyer, Alan Stein, who actually sued successfully the government of Canada back in the day. And now he's suing them on the behalf of the kids survivors. And we're going to actually interview some of the kids survivors that tell us more about a closer story. Dr. Cameron in McGill, in affiliation with CIA and with support of Canadian government, experimented MK Ultra experiments on the people of Canada. And the idea behind those experiments was, how can you, even though he says we did it, you know, the Dr. Cameron, he says we did it to help the people, you know, to overcome the traumatic experiences and trauma. It was later discovered that, you know, there was something more malevolent to it. And we can't really interview Dr. Cameron because he was sort of dead shortly after all those things became discovered. But the point of those MK Ultra studies were how to alter people's behavior without their knowledge. So things like Charles Manson, you know, the kind of Manchurian candidates and all that stuff. So here's me asking the John Mack question. What if he was one of those Dr. Cameron types and he was actively working with some kind of institution, the CIA, et cetera, and he was already part of the project and he went there to collect the data. And let's say they did the, you know, Project Bluebeam. And that's why maybe I brought it up originally, maybe those aliens, because based on your description, maybe they were holographic images and somehow they were able to project those images into people's heads. And I don't know. I don't have the technology behind it, but they've been doing it since 49.
Yeah.
So like 94, 49, it's a pretty big span. Maybe by then already they had some kind of technology and it was a big government experiment. And maybe the forces to be don't want this to come out, because either way, either it's an alien story or MK Ultra story.
Or it's a test run for something bigger in the future.
Right. Yeah, something bigger in the future that we're not aware of. They don't want this to come out publicly. Like, that's what I mean. Like, if we go outside right now and we look up in the sky and we see, what do they call them, UAPs now?
Yeah.
And we see a UAP. And it's really hard to identify. Is it, you know, Elon Musk's new project? Is it?
Yeah, it doesn't. You don't know anymore.
You don't know anymore, right? One thing, like the way I feel, the way you're telling the story, is definitely why I'm even asking those questions about John Mack, because it's a traumatic experience. And what they did in the MK Ultra experiences, they actually used childhood trauma.
Yeah.
Because brain compartmentalizes itself. And like the things that you were talking about, like they get those flashes. And this is the way you compartmentalize and put input data into a brain to reactivate on the later moment in life by snap of a finger or by some kind of activation. And they may not even be aware of this or recall it. So this to me seems very similar, right? There's a little bit of crossover there. And I'm just hypothetical about it, obviously. I wouldn't know, but it seems like maybe aliens using the same technology. It's interesting that you brought up the Christian family. It's Emily. That's her family was Christian.
Yeah.
And in Christian philosophy and tradition, the way people talk about what is good, what, you know, God associated with good, devil associated with bad. If you receive some kind of message or vision or you experience something in life and you feel good about it, you know, just feeling wise, that is from God. And if you don't feel good about it, like those kids, it's probably isn't. So to me, it seems like it was not necessarily a good, oh, look, I'm giving you a message into the future, guys. This is, I'm a good guy. I'm telling you something about to happen in the future. I'm giving you a warning heads up. But kids walked away with a really negative experience, trauma, as you described.
That's right.
So it seems a malevolent kind of event to me in general, like based on your description of the kids.
Well, that's not necessarily the case, because the way you have to look at a response from anybody is basically, if you're, you know, 10 years old and you really like Oreo cookies, you really like them. Like, you really want Oreo cookies. You've been dreaming about them since you were in class in the morning. And you go, when I get home, I want to have Oreo cookies. And your parents are going to tell you, no, Alex, you got to have dinner first. And then it's like you're getting trauma in a way. You're like being told no and go to your room and stay there because you're now, you've been pushing too much to get your Oreo cookies. So go to your room. So you're going to go in your room and you're going to be upset, and there's going to be call it a micro trauma of the fact that you didn't get your cookies when you wanted them, but it wasn't malevolent. Your parents didn't do that for any malevolent reason. They want to be, you know, good parents and keep you healthy and make sure you have your dinner first, and then they'll give you a cookie. So I don't think that was the creatures did not appear to have some malevolence to them, because if they were malevolent, I mean, again, I'm just basing myself on the information I have. There's a lot of information that we probably don't have of what happened that day. But I didn't see that as malevolent. I think in fact, saying the way let me actually say it to how I said it to my mom one time. My mom is, born in Rome, Italian Catholic, very conservative woman. And we're sitting down talking about what happened at Ariel. And, my mom, while I'm explaining it to her, she stopped me and she said, imagine how amazing this is, that they chose to go see children, which is the most innocent part of our species. And they went to see many children where there is a very clear limitation to how you can manipulate so many children to lie in the same way and convince people in the same way for years, which is something that we haven't accomplished. MK Ultra has accomplished certain things, but to do that in the way that it happened at Ariel is kind of there's almost like difficulty there to accomplish what happened there. and to give them a message that is predominantly directed to everybody. So it's not necessarily a message that comes to the kids only for them to do. It's a message that has to do with all of us, all colors, all genders, all creed, whatever. And to have that message rely on faith. Now, this is where it goes further into the systems of human species, where we have tremendous, like there's faith with Catholics, Christians, Muslim, whatever, but there's faith, or you believe wholeheartedly, there's faith that, you have faith and you believe in the love that you have with your mother or with your parent or whatever. And so here we are having to make a decision as a species. Do I accept these children? Do I accept that children are telling me, I'm an adult, I'm the U.S. government, or I'm the Polish government, or I'm Joe Blow and fucking in a tribe somewhere. It doesn't matter. Is do I accept truth from these kids that these beings came down and said, we need to be careful about the way we use water and air and how we use technology? Because at the end of the day, it comes down to the most elementary part of our being as a human, who, if I put a gun to your head, And I say you have a 1 second split decision here. Who do you trust? A 7-year-old or a 32-year-old lawyer?
7-year-old.
That's easy. Right? It's an instant thing. Or who do you trust? An 8-year-old or a politician?
8-year-old.
You know what I'm saying? So the way that reality bleeds into us is gonna, it has more power than any disclosure, any government, anything that anybody says, because at the end of the day, it's coming from a legally prepared, manufactured event versus a very organic human thing.
What if CIA knew about this reaction and they're like, oh, we'll got to do it for the kids because then everybody will believe them.
Well, let's put it this
Alex,
way.
Alex, I was going to say, in terms of malevolence, if that was their plan, it's a really kind of very low-tech, low-intelligence way of going about it.
No, I'm not talking about...
More malevolent thing to do would be not give the kids the message and just let the earth destroy itself.
Oh, no. I'm not talking about... That's what I'm saying. I don't have the details. Like, I haven't seen the aerial phenomenon. I'm just quite... Based on my talk with research and MKUltra, and that's what happens is like any experience that is traumatic is usually used for malevolence.
I'm actually gonna go further.
The government, sorry to cut you guys off. I think if the government would have been involved in this, I think they would have tried to start a race war.
Too. Like
they did in the U.S.
By the way, the school, if you watch in Zimbabwe, right? If you watch some of the documentary, the kids are white.
There's a lot of white kids.
But a lot of our perception is like Africa black, white people live in Africa in plenty.
Which actually brings me to another point that my mom actually forgot to say. One more thing she said was, she goes, look at what they did. They landed in a school in rural Africa where it just so happened that school had children from all over the world. Which is really interesting, right? Yeah. Because it's not something that is a common thing in Africa that you go to a primary school and there would be children from everywhere there. That's kind of an interesting piece too. I was going to say something about MKUltra. I spent a big part of my life researching the CIA, mm-hmm. so I can speak on...
You appreciate my doubts.
Yeah. But what one of the things that I will say about the CIA or any counterintelligence or intelligence agency out there, whether it's American, whether it's Russian, whether it's Italian, mm-hmm. doesn't matter. The distortion and the manipulation is usually done post-event, not pre-event. So... Because they can't call shots around the world all the time, right? So they could do a lot of organized manipulation. They can have organized programs and secret projects that are, in fact, working on deception. And that's something that they've spent a lot of money on. But when something happens that is outside of their control, which is something like this, the only thing they can do is then take it and then spin it their way from that point. So you could essentially control anything you want if you control the access to media outlets, information, and academia. So the more, the dangerous part of the CIA or anyone who has the real malevolent intention, in my opinion, is that they will take data and they will spin that data so that you start looking at it differently. Because I can say the story of what happened at Ariel and everybody starts going like, my God, this is crazy. And at the end, somebody comes in and says, hey, Luigi, but did you tell them that there was a lot of heroin in Zimbabwe at the time? Did you tell them that? Which is not true, but I'm just saying. And suddenly I just, wait a minute. Everybody just goes like, what? You just seeded heroin in the story? So all of a sudden you start thinking, maybe there was, what the fuck? So, and that's post-event. So I could change your mind on anything if I have enough bad intentions and budget to do it. So that's pretty much easy to do, because I could throw out, we could walk away, I shake Jason's hand and be like, hey man, just watch out, because Alex, you know, he was arrested a couple of times for sexual harassment. You know what I'm saying? And it's not true. And then all of a sudden, you'll never look at him the same. And it's so the CIA is notorious for that, you know. So there's a big distinction, in my opinion, between real solid events versus manufactured events, and then there's the post real solid events manufactured stories. And then that's what creates this mishmash. That's why none of this stuff ever makes it anywhere, because it's first of all so crazy to think that something like this can happen. And then you think, wow, that crazy that happened. And then you think, oh shit, look what the MK Ultra program was. That's crazy that happened. And then you start going like, what do I believe anymore? You know what I mean? So it's
getting harder and harder.
It's getting harder and harder. Yeah, that's right.
I was going to say, speaking as someone who wishes to remain in a childlike state the rest of his life, that maybe instead of malevolence, what they felt was an enormous sense of responsibility. That as a child, that's kind of heavy, knowing that, oh my God, I'm growing up with this thing that I've been given, this whatever.
I'm not gonna disagree with you on how you perceive it. I'm just being a devil's advocate. Just last question regarding the malevolence. No, I think those are a really interesting way of looking at the things. The way I'm looking at this, also, I'm from the Christian perspective, from the family, like including your mom, right? Because to Christians, anything other than, you know, God and people, everything else is of the devil.
That's right.
And if you look into research of people like L.A. Marzulli, who's been researching UFOs for a long time, and like alien contact and all that, they came naturally to a conclusion that there's also something spiritual about it. Mm-hmm. So like, let's say anything other than God must be the demons. And maybe there's something about that as well, because they use example of people later on in life that, let's say, they have abduction experiences throughout their whole life, and then they find Jesus and they call on Jesus, and either coincidentally or not, they have those events subsiding. So last devil's advocate question, like, what if it was demon tricking people? You know how, like you're saying, CIA lies to people, they just give you part truth.
Yeah.
So maybe there's something there too, but they were using, you know, maybe it was the trickster kind of thing situation.
I mean, there's no question that there, in my research, I can say that I've heard stories that indicate to me that there was a malevolent intent versus stories that there wasn't. But then again, it's still difficult because we don't have the whole picture. Now, as far as the religious aspect of malevolence, this is where I get, this is kind of where I really have fun with religion and religious, with people who are extremely religious, is I say, well, based on the fact that you are religious and based on the fact that you follow the word, we'll go with Catholic, you know, Christians, you follow the word of God or Jesus and whatnot. In your mind, in your understanding of your religion, Jesus is good. Nothing is bad. God is good. Angels are good. There's positivity. There's heaven. There's angels with these beautiful white feathers. Yet, in the world that God placed us in, we have sexual urges. We do really rough sexual things to each other every day as a species because it provides us pleasure. That's not written in the Bible. That's not something that's in the Bible going, you know, you should really try this with your partner. This is really going to get fucking night rocking. You know what I mean? So
I just got weird images of angels and feathers and something else.
So but I'm saying what we do is that we take our concept of God and religion and we package it without all the realities that we actually do every day. You know what I mean? So and I always bring sexuality into it because that's the number one thing you won't talk about in religion. And it's like, well, aren't we all running after that daily? You know what I'm saying? Like, isn't that a primal instinct of our species?
Are you saying that you encounter a bit of resistance when you bring up this topic from them?
That's right.
Like almost they're afraid of it?
Exactly. They're afraid of it. They don't want to face it because they know that they're going to have to admit to it. And to me, the malevolence idea when you compare it to religion is before you compare alien malevolence to your religion, let's compare your religion to human behavior.
To human nature, yeah.
Yeah, to human nature, exactly. And then we'll talk about the malevolence.
I heard something somewhere a long time ago that from a teacher of MSD, moral social development, was I have both God and the devil inside me. I'll try to control myself.
It's
kind of like that, to ignore one and favor the other is to deny what you are.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. You're denying what you are. And at the end of the day, you know, they'll always say, well, yes, we know that that's what we have, but we have to fight. We have to be strong and have to have faith and have to be good. Yeah.
What's good?
I was going to say, what's your definition of good?
And is it your definition?
That's right. Yeah, we could go down that rabbit hole forever.
I agree. Actually, there's a lot of points that you brought up here. And if we rely on human definition of God, if we rely on human definition of good, then we're limited. But we need to rely on God's definition of God. People that read scripture, and again, we will depend which scripture to read and all that stuff. Yeah. Then we'll was like, no, that's a wrong scripture. And again, who decides it's a wrong scripture, right? And then if we accept scripture as the word of God and you read scripture every day, how many people actually read scripture every day? Like
Not many.
So there's good lessons in there that will tell you about adultery and all that stuff. It doesn't matter if you're Christian, Muslim, etc., especially Abrahamic faiths. But to me, actually going back to your original idea that the aliens came in and talked to kids, and then now we have to accept kids as a messengers. To me, again, it's going back to the faith-based thing and the spiritual thing, because God talked to us through different channel. And this is an innocent channel that hasn't been polluted yet the way, let's say, we pollute the earth.
That's right.
Right? Fukushima, good example, right? So we haven't polluted the kids yet. So they psychic is pure. And maybe that's why they were able to imprint those messages into those brains at such a frequency, because they were not filled with other stuff.
And the purity of the child. Yeah.
So I'm willing to accept this in the mechanical way, but I can also see where the spiritually based people would challenge this, saying like, well, it's done against their will and God wouldn't do it because you have free agency and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. So it must be malevolent, right? So I would accept that.
Well, to the same argument though, if you think about things that have happened to people, forget the aliens completely and talk about daily life. How many times have you had something horrible happen to you and somebody will say, well, you know what, maybe this is what God wants for you. You know what I mean? Because they have so much faith that it's like, you know, the fact that you lost your leg is probably something that was meant to be for you, for something better. And it's like, no, fuck you. I lost my leg. You know what I mean? So it's like they're going to use God when they want to use God as a good thing. But when God, when there's something malevolent, well, when they want it to be malevolent, they'll call it malevolent. So there's a lot of, you know, discriminatory selection of ways.
I think what you do with the situation determines what power source you're tapping from.
Yeah, that's right.
I know people that have been, will take a disability and rise above it.
Yeah.
And then you look at that and go, damn, I've got nothing wrong with me. And look at what this guy is doing and he has no leg. Where does that drive come from?
Well, but regardless, yeah, that's a very good point. But all that put together is that there absolutely is no real solid argument that anyone can say to bridge malevolence into something like that, because there's so many things we can bring up in the regular daily environment that they're not using as malevolent, but they're saying God wanted that. So it's like, maybe God wanted, let's assume there's a God. Let's assume this God is made a son and is that son is Jesus, and that, it's complete assumption. Okay. We have way more evidence on aliens than we have on what I'm talking about with Jesus.
God?
Yeah.
I think, I can't say, I just think that there's too much, we want to ascribe human characteristics to something we can't explain.
That's right.
And I don't know that.
And the same thing, I think, would it be aliens or God? Like we cannot describe either or in human language.
That's right.
26 letters of English.
I didn't hear what you said.
We cannot describe either or in human language because they are not human. That's it. So that's the point. Well, then get to the personal. What do you think the aliens are then? Like in that particular case, or do you're going to say willing to hypothesize? Was there any information? Say we came from Zeta Reticuli, or I don't know, we came from some other dimension. Like, was there any of that evidence?
Anything that has to do with aliens, we talked about this in the last podcast we had together. Is I always say something that is quite. It's quite universal on Earth, not just with our species, but all the species that are on Earth. Okay. So we're surrounded with species here. I mean, whether we're human, but we've got dogs, cats, there's mammal animals and birds and fish and insects. And there's tons of species
just on this planet,
And within, let's just talk about our species, human species. So the human species is an incredibly diverse species with many different colors, many different cultural ways of going about their lives or their habits, their social habits, their belief systems. But regardless of all that, there is a black and white inside when I say black and white, I mean a good and bad within every single human being. So the species itself cannot be painted in one color because there's so many varieties of our species. And within each variety of our species, we have good and bad. So there's great Russian guys and there's shitty Russian guys. And then there's great Italian guys and there's shitty Italian. Does that make all Russians good or all Russians bad? No. Does it make it all Italians good? No, it doesn't. So when we look at aliens and whatever they're doing, we immediately jump to this conclusion of, are they malevolent? Well, maybe in one particular case they were, but they're not malevolent. Or were they super noble and helpful and helped? Maybe they were in one case, but not in all. The reality must apply to all different species. That reality applies to dogs. There's some dogs that are super nice and some dogs that are more aggressive. There's some lions that are super nice and some that are super aggressive. Now, there's a documentary out of a guy who went out in, I think, in the north and was living with bears. I don't know if you've seen this.
And his girlfriend got eaten.
Exactly. Yeah. They got by this one bear at the end. I don't know if you saw this, but anyway, they were videotaping the bear. Now, they were close to bears for years.
They're saying it's the woman's fault. They're saying he shouldn't have brought her because she was afraid and then triggered the bear.
But whatever the case was, the bears were super nice until that one bear killed both of them. Now, what are we going to do? Are we going to say that all the bears are bad? You know what I mean? Because that one bear attacked two people. So the same thing applies all over the earth. We have good bears, bad bears. We have good humans, bad humans. So by that logic, we should also consider that there could be the same logic applying to life, the cycle of life throughout the universe. And it is very possible that there's some good aliens and bad aliens. And what sucks is that we don't have information either way. What we have is these little bits and pieces of the puzzle of something they did. And you go, okay, was it that the same as that? Or, you know, and then some people say, you know, they categorize, David Jacobs does this a lot, and they categorize aliens within a species, you know, like these are the grays, these are the Nordics, these are the insectolins, these are the, you know, the praying mantis types and all this stuff.
There's Poseidon.
There's all sorts of different, there are actually, you know, there's a ton of different species that have been witnessed. Now, at that, if we start looking at that and we start really taking that seriously, then we are way, way behind on figuring out what the hell is going on if there's even more than one type. So, and that really opens Pandora's box. I think there's
definitely more than one type. Oh, I mean, yeah. Look at how many different types of breakfast cereal there is on the shelf. So
yeah.
More than people. Yeah. Look at five of us sitting here. We all kind of come from the, even though we're like all white guys, we all look different. All different.
Yeah, different.
Like if you present us to some other species, they're going to be like, ooh, this is a gray alien. This is a gray alien with a beard.
Yeah.
This is another gray alien. Right. Yeah. And this Poseidon. By the way, Poseidon, I don't think you're an alien. I think I'm a bigger alien than you anyway. Well, size-wise anyway.
Look, I don't know what I am. I'm barely human, so.
So definitely, there's a question in there.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Regarding the types or species, have you ever heard of a small, wrinkly, copper-colored type?
Interesting you talk about that. How small and how? Give me more details.
Hard to say. Maybe between 3 and 4.5 feet tall.
Okay.
Very wrinkly, almost as if it looked like extreme age, but the wrinkles are not necessarily what we would associate with sagging features. Mm-hmm. Just seem more like part of what they are.
What they are.
It was all over, like maybe muscles, or like if you see someone that's really ripped, you see the striations of the muscles like that, but on their face, on their body.
And how big are they?
I would say like children.
Okay, like, so thin.
Thin,
yeah.
Thin but wiry.
Yeah. So, yes, there are quite a few cases that I've heard of the creatures being wrinkled, like very, very wrinkly everywhere. There's quite a few cases of the color being a brownish color, okay? So brown is not like a rare thing heard about it.
Brownish red.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. So they're not all gray, you know, like there's a lot of different varieties that I've heard about. What's interesting is hearing them from people who've seen or experienced something, because the description is identical to somebody else going, do you think that there's, like, the same way you just asked me? I've been asked exactly that question, I can't tell you many times, of the exact description. You know what I mean?
That particular type.
So it does make sense that there could be a type like that. Now, I don't have evidence of that. They don't either. You don't either. But where did that come from? Why are people asking that question that way?
Tell me, where did it come from? I know you want to tell me.
Yeah, okay. It was a dream, or what I believe to be a dream. For a long time, I lived in upstate Maine, small northern hunting and fishing town. I was 8 years old, and I used to get constantly babysat by my grandparents. They lived in a mobile home.
Right.
With those kind of windows that you would screw open and
it opens
like this. One night, it was on the weekend, either a Friday or a Saturday, I don't remember exactly which, but I was awake because there was a light coming from somewhere. It woke me up. Mm-hmm. And so the window in front of the room I slept at was, you know how mobile homes are made. Mm-hmm. It's a hallway.
Yeah.
And then the rooms are all on the other side, yeah, of the hallway, and the hallway is against the exterior wall.
That's right, yeah.
I was looking to see in the backyard to see where the light was coming from, because it felt like it was coming from outside. Mm-hmm. So I went to see if I could open the
little door
so I could look, yeah, and see, but it looked like a very bright moon. I couldn't see what the source of the light was, but the entire backyard was lit up. Hmm. I went there and couldn't find it. And then my grandparents' bedroom was down the hall and I could see it. The door was slightly ajar and I looked down the hallway and I walked closer, and that's when
you saw.
Saw two creatures hovering over, when I say hovering, it, I don't mean floating, I mean just over my grandparents in the bed, and it looked like they were doing something, like mm-hmm. maybe medical or mm-hmm. maybe mm-hmm. I don't know what. Mm-hmm. And then one looked at me and I screamed. And that's kind of the last thing I remember. I screamed, I turned, I ran and down the hallway, and then I woke up on the couch in the living room, not in my bedroom.
Mm.
And
do you remember what the creature looked like when it looked at you? What did you see in his facial features? Its facial features.
Just surprise, maybe. Like it did not expect. I shouldn't be looking at it.
Looking at it.
I shouldn't be looking at it.
How old were you?
Maybe 8.
Okay.
Something like that.
And did you have a chance to see what its eyes looked like?
No real detail. Just, I remember contact. That's all I can say. Mm. Like, I'm to tell you right now, kind of maybe black, but I'm not sure.
You're not
sure. I just know that there was a connection.
There was a connection.
There was a connection when it looked at me, and then I turned and ran, and then boom.
Gone.
Yeah.
Do you remember where they were standing by the bed?
Yes. One was, my grandfather was sleeping on the left side of the bed. My uh-huh. grandmother was on the
right side.
The other side.
Yeah.
So one was over her, one was over him.
So they were on each side.
Yeah. And the one that was over my grandfather was the one that looked at me.
That looked at you.
Yeah.
Okay. And where were their arms?
The one that was over my grandfather, his left arm was kind of over the chest area, okay, or something. Mm-hmm. I want to say that they had something in their hand, but I don't.
You don't know for sure. Yeah. And your grandparents were sleeping.
Yes.
They were out. Right?
Yes, they were completely out.
And when you remember this as if it was a dream, but you're not sure if it
I've
was.
I've had a lot of dreams, dude, but this was
not
different.
Like Yeah. So you see this light source, you try to open this little window, you can't see what's up there because the glass is there and you
yeah, you know how they open like a
but you and could see that it's lighting up.
I could see the I would call it the courtyard, but it's actually the backyard, but everything
was lit.
Kind of a bluish.
Okay.
You know, like a really bright full moon.
Electric light, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Like a bright full moon.
Like
a bluish tint, I don't know.
A bluish tint. Yeah. So it was quite lit.
More than what's normal.
What's normal.
Yeah.
And so, and the door was slightly open in the bedroom.
Enough for me to see.
Mm.
You know, I could not see the edge of the wall, but the door was open enough that I could see the creature, and I could sense like there was another one there because I knew it was there. Yeah.
And when it looked at you, that's when you yelled. That's when you screamed, right? And you turned back like running.
To run
the other way, right? Yeah. So you were about the same size of these beings because you were small. Is that fair to say that it was a similar size as you, as they were small?
Yep.
Right.
I'd say that. Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot there because you were young. You were like 8 years old, right? Roughly 8 years old. So there's a lot there that could have happened. And there's a lot of things that would have to be approached with delicately and investigated delicately. There's a lot that just happened there. So one is you are not too really convinced that this was a dream, because you have had many dreams, and this was kind of like a, you felt something happen. You also did not wake up in your bed. You woke up on the couch, which is a, is in itself, you moved somehow, sometime in the middle of the night, right?
Yeah. And the couch isn't really comfortable. It's covered in plastic because my grandmother had the
one of those.
The entire living room was covered in plastic.
So basically you, and did you have, or do you have any history of sleepwalking or anything that could potentially have?
I've had a few other, I don't know what to call them, out of normal paranormal experiences, but not like that. Not with other creatures.
Not with other
creatures.
They
were usually feelings. I mean, I had one, I was in military prison for a period of time. And I had a out of body experience.
Okay. So So the out of body experience, that was actually my next question. It was, did you ever have an out of body experience?
So really vivid.
You've had that. Okay.
This one was later in life.
Mm-hmm. So you see there's some little points that make me more interested in this particular story with your grandparents. And what do your grandparents remember of that? Did you ever have a conversation with them? Did you ever bring it up to them?
The next day, kinda, but there was no.
Yeah, because you were young.
Yeah. So I think they just wrote it off as a bad dream.
As a bad dream. Yeah. Okay.
But for me, like, I've had bad dreams before. I could say I know the difference.
Yeah.
This was something else.
Different. Yeah.
That's all I can say. I can't say what it was.
There, you know, there's the fact that you physically woke up in a different location is important. The fact that you remember opening the window in that type of way and seeing a light is important. The fact that one of the creatures looked at you and you yelled and walked and ran, and then that's kind of where it like stopped.
Yeah.
That's also important.
But it's weird. I never, this detail didn't hit me until I'm telling you now, was the contact. I just realized it was, and I forgot it or, but in telling you, the idea that I shouldn't be
looking at it,
like as
you
if
shouldn't
they,
be aware.
They, what, put me under or whatever, but I woke up
and
something
up.
Happened.
Yeah.
Like, hey, yo, we gotta.
Yeah.
Like,
this is actually, I was actually speaking to somebody yesterday, believe it or not. Somebody came to my office yesterday and we were having a conversation. And because I'm working on a project right now that has to do with UFOs and stuff, she brought up something to one of my colleagues and she says, something happened to me the other night, but I don't know if I want to really talk about it because you guys are going to think I'm crazy. And I was not in the conversation. I was overhearing this. And she says, I woke up and I was looking at myself and my boyfriend in bed. I was outside of my body. She says, I was looking at myself and I turned to my right and there's three small beings that are brown colored. She said that are right by the bed.
This was when?
She told me this yesterday.
Oh.
Yeah, it happened maybe like a couple of months ago. And she says, and one of them looked at me and got startled, like, I'm not supposed to be seeing this. And that was gone. Like, she goes, I don't know what happened after that. And it's interesting because it just so happened to be a conversation that was mentioned to me. The girl seems very... She's an accountant, so she's, you know, very serious person. And she goes, I never experienced anything like that. It scared the crap out of me because as soon as it saw that I was looking at it, it like everything stopped.
Meanwhile, up in space, this race is going, yo, dude, our generation
work,
5 neuro paralyzer,
yeah, exactly.
It's like, we got to replace it. This thing is just malfunctioning
right?
everywhere.
Like, so, and this is something that I've honestly heard multiple times where they for some reason don't have the full ability to knock us out completely. And I'm assuming something happened. I'm not saying something that I'm just like, if this was something
in,
like that,
in any of the other stories, was there anything, I don't know, like, does it go further? Do we know what they want? Do we know what
this
they
is?
Seem to be
okay.
Doing?
So I'll give
have
you,
there been other brown alien stories that have been collected? Yes. Because I never hear brown copperish ones.
So well, I know I have. Yeah. So one of the things that just so you know a little bit about my background in particularly this part of the research, because there's, you know, a lot of people can have a lot of experience in this phenomenon in many different sections of it. But the abduction phenomenon and the alien encounter phenomenon is something that I spent a long time in my life researching and learning about. And my I would say my mentor or the person who taught me the most about this is a gentleman called David Jacobs. So you Google David Jacobs. He's very known. He's spent 45, almost 50 years of his life investigating alien abductions. And he was my teacher for a while. And one of the things that he said to me when I first started learning from him was anytime you meet somebody who has had an experience, who they remember part of their experience, and they want to go further in understanding that experience, he says, I want you to promise me that you will do everything you can to convince them not to do that. And I said, why? This was at the very beginning. He says, because if ever we go deeper into that experience and something comes out, whether that be through hypnotic regression or through questions which bring out other things and it alerts your brain, your subconscious brain starts thinking and it matures itself over a few days and then you remember something, could in most cases, it's probably not going to be that big of a problem. He says, but I have seen it enough in my experience, he said, that it caused some people to become suicidal.
Eesh.
Yeah.
Wow.
So he says, you are not dealing with something that they're not dealing with something that they're necessarily that ready to deal with. So this is something that is... He was very, very, like, it almost felt like that was, if you don't agree with this, I'm not going to teach you anything. You know, it was like, you have to promise me to do that. And so, obviously, I did.
But that's kind of counter to what you were doing. I mean, how do you investigate and probe people's experiences?
Because there's other things that, like, for instance, you know, what you've experienced seems to be a quite of a mild something. It was quite a long time ago. It wasn't repetitive.
Whatever it was, I dealt with it.
You dealt with it. In some cases, it gets to the point where people have had babies, or they've had abortions, or they lost a baby, or they had a pregnancy, lost the baby, and then they're pregnant again, and then something's going on, and something's really weird, and there's other cases where they find themselves with marks on their bodies or scoop marks of their skin and it gets to the point where it's like, what the fuck is going on? And some people are already traumatized because they remember part of it and the trauma is already there. It's already there. And so they want to know more because actually knowing once you're in a traumatic situation and you are under trauma, the additional trauma might actually reduce the trauma because the additional information might clarify more because the trauma is also because I don't know what everything happened. I want to know exactly what happened, you know? So it kind of sometimes could help later. If you know a little bit more about what happened, you say, okay, got it. That now it's horrible, but I was already traumatized. If you're happy, if you're fine, if you're healthy and it doesn't repeat, but you think you've had something, but it's like hasn't affected you, there's no reason to go dig into that simply to find to give you even more evidence that there was something that happened because maybe it's not valid or not worth enough to then bring it into your life, which will cause your brain to never stop thinking about it forever. But there's also some people who are like this way I'm feeling from you. Yeah. Is it you know, you can handle it.
I've had other
weird. But that's my point. So you can, you can handle it. Well, there's a lot of people that can't, you know, there's
I understand.
You know, there's a lot of people that are extremely sensitive to something like this, because it completely breaks their sense of reality. It shatters everything they believe in. And so that's could be very traumatic for some people.
That I understand. But yeah. I mean, if your grasp on reality is tenuous at best.
Yeah. Now, if you are interested to go in deep into that, what I recommend is that you find, I can even recommend them for you, but you find somebody who is a very good hypnotherapist. And going through hypnotic regression might not actually do anything, okay? But it might also shed light on something else.
Yeah.
And maybe that's something that you want to know.
I was just going to bring this up. You stole my thunder. Right? Yeah. So I actually know the story, and we can talk about this subject forever. So I'm going to wrap it up with the story. And I think this is so fascinating. We need to meet for round two for sure. And I want to discuss you. New project that you're working with Bob Lazar.
Yeah.
It's like I'm thinking Bob Lazar have been drained so much already. Like, what else can you get out of Bob Lazar? So I'm super curious. Let's meet for round two for that. But
for sure.
For hypnotic regression, I have a story. I know somebody very close that had a hypnotic regression unrelated to phenomenon. Mm-hmm. It was a therapeutic relaxation kind of thing, like get deep into your subconscious and see what's bothering you, and then you may be able to face it. And so they went into hypnotic regression, and then they saw like a face of an angel, and they came out of it. And hypnotist says it's some kind of protection, subconscious protection. It's like, but let's try it again. Who knows? Because it felt good. It was just a beautiful angel. Right. They go the second time, and now the person sees, you know, they go for the whole hypnotic process, and then they see the face of like alien / demon creature, the scariest face they ever seen, like very distinct. And again, comes out of the hypnotic state and says, and now therapist says, well, there's some kind of block there. I'm not sure if I'm equipped to handle it. You know, they finalize it, they close the session, the person leaves. From that night onwards, for like many, many months and years, or all the events that happened in person's life, that wasn't even aware that they were lifelong abductee. Or if they were aware, they were suppressing it in compartmentalized brain.
Yeah.
All those events from like young childhood start to come up onwards. And it really like messed up their life for the following next month they started to relieve all those traumatic experiences.
For sure.
So maybe I agree with you. Maybe like if you're not sure if you want to really open that can of worms. So not in your case, you stuntman. You're not scared of anything. But in general, like it definitely should be, I agree with you, should be a warning sign attached to that.
Agreed. Yeah. But at the same time, look, I've done everything.
Yeah. So you're ready. Yeah, exactly. That was going to say, like, I could tell.
Big deal. Okay, do you want to, what are you going to tell me? I'm going to die. I know that.
Yeah.
You know,
there's, you know, when I meet people who've had the experiences while they're telling me the experience, I'm doing two things. I'm listening carefully to what the experience is or what they remember, but I'm paying more attention to how nervous and how their
emotional state.
Yeah, because it's going to give, and also sometimes they come with their partner or their family, and I'll also be looking at them, because it also going to, in my mind, I'm thinking, the more they dig deep into this, if the family member doesn't even believe this is going on. Like if, cause sometimes I've seen that. Okay. Then you're going to create even more of a problem, because you're going to go deeper into something that's going to go even crazier. And then they're going to be even more going like, this is ridiculous. This cannot be. And then that person is now facing another problem. So it's quite sensitive. But in your case, I can tell that, you know, I can be like,
I'm used to bucking the system. So yeah. It doesn't really bother me much. Yeah.
So let's close the show. It's been amazing. I really want to do part two with you on the Bob Lazar story. Sure. And so come back in a few weeks. Well, and I want you to be back for this too.
I'd love to.
I'm curious if you guys are interested into this. And Val's here is a documentarist and videographer. you know, what if we do hypnotic regression and with the document the ordeal if you into it kind of thing?
Oh, me do it?
Yeah.
Can we wait till after the round?
Yeah, yeah.
Because if it does screw me up for a bit, I got to finish my work.
Okay, no, yeah.
Like in September.
Yeah. On your terms.
Yeah.
On your
terms. September.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I don't mind.
You're going to be a lab rat. Perfect.
Lab rat. I like that.
All right.
Yeah.
So thank you, Luigi.
My pleasure,
Jason.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
It's
been
very informative. So Aerial Phenomena, last piece of advice, it should go on the website.
Go on Aerial Phenomenon, A-R-I-E-L, aerialphenomenon.com.
And we'll put a link.
Rent the movie.
We'll put a link in the show.
Check it out. Yeah.
Thank you all. It's been great.
Cool.
Thank you, Poseidon.
Thank you, man.
Thanks,
Val.
Thank you.